Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker will be Matt Morton, Chief Information Security Officer and Assistant Chief Information Officer for the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He'll speak on the topic, Cybersecurity in a Global Economy, How Do We Assure Growth While Protecting Our Digital Lives? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, July 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Marcia Cady, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today we ask this question, do we really have cybersecurity? First, it was Target. Then this year, insurance companies, and now the federal government. The biggest breach of personal information ever, 21.5 million current and former federal employees. With so many hacks, are we still even taking notice? We should, because the merging of our lives, physical lives, and our online lives are going to continue. Matt Morton, the Chief Information Security Officer and Assistant CIO of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, is here today to provide a real-life history of the growth and merger of those two lives and give us some direct examples of strategies for dealing with the risks. Matt is an alumni of UNO and has a master's in higher education administration from Upper Iowa University. He also holds a CISSP certification from the International Information Systems Security Certification Consortium and is an adjunct faculty member in the Peter Kiewit Institute School of Interdisciplinary Informatics. Matt will speak for about 30 minutes, and then he will take your questions. There is paper and pencils at your table. Write down your questions, and we'll have a member of our committee bring those pieces of paper up, and then I will ask Matt your questions. So for now, please join me in welcoming Matt Morton.
Thank you. It's great to be back in Seattle. Oh, wait. Sorry, I was confused. All the rain was kind of clogging my brain there a little bit. No, seriously, it's great to be here. It's great to see all the people in here. I see a lot of familiar faces. Appreciate you coming out and supporting us in this very important topic. You know, when Marcia asked me if I would be interested in presenting at the Omaha Press Club on cybersecurity, I jumped at the opportunity because this is something that I feel very passionate about. In other words, I feel like it is one of the battles that we are working with in today's world that is going to shape the next 50 years. I also thought, what a great opportunity to use some really fancy lingo and talk in terms that no one would understand. No, I'm just kidding. I'll try to keep my terms like exfiltration, data breach, what are some other ones? Lots of other ones, antivirus, malware, etc. Keep those to a minimum. But if you have any questions at the end and there was something that wasn't clear, feel free to ask that question at that time. So, do we really need cybersecurity? That was the question that, you know, Marcia posed earlier. And of course, you probably know my answer to that, but let's explore that just a little bit, right? I mean, isn't this just an overblown attempt, right, to just complicate an already overcomplicated world filled with technology? My hope here is that in this time that we spend together, that we identify and not only see the need for cybersecurity, but that you understand it at a little deeper level, how complicated it is, how to protect yourself, what you can do when you go back to your organizations that you work for to help them understand what they need to do if they don't already. In addition, I hope I can ignite a spark in you so that you can help participate in the conversation that needs to happen nationally on this topic, so we can work together to guide business leaders and policymakers on the importance of protecting your data. So cybersecurity, as Marcia mentioned, you know, it's something we're hearing a lot about. We hear a lot of the breaches, right? We hear a lot of the negatives, a lot of the things that are going on, and that's for good reason. Many organizations, corporate, nonprofit, government, and yes, universities, have been subjected to breaches and attacks and have essentially had their defenses overwhelmed. The primary goal in the past on these attacks has been typically focused on stealing financial information or information that, the attackers could sell. However, now these attempts, as Marcia was talking about with the Office of Personnel Management, Anthem, Primera, are getting more personal. They're targeted on the very details of our own lives. You know, our planet has become increasingly linked globally as we continue to rely more heavily on technology for all aspects of our lives, work, home, entertainment. You can't help but wonder if we're indeed creating such a dependency that it could be exploited to gain further control over our lives and the information that we possess. You know, the most recent attack and subsequent breach of the Office of Personnel Management highlights this new strategy. After two separate attacks, it's been revealed that the personal details of the security clearance interviews of not now just 21.5 million, but actually 25 million Americans has been stolen. So that number's risen even since the last report. In addition, 2.1 million fingerprints of government workers were taken. The information stolen is, we're talking about the gory details of people's lives. People's lives are messy. Everybody knows this. So these are the details that arose from the questioning for those top secret clearances. When you look at the outcome and then you couple that with what happened at Anthem, Primera, Care First, which are all Blue Cross Blue Shield organizations, you start to see a pattern. The pattern is pointing to a potential plot, I think, to profile government workers for either future targeted attacks or perhaps even blackmail. We were talking briefly about how little time you actually have to answer email, for example, in our daily lives, and how that time to respond is sometimes being impacted by the content of that email. I'll talk a little bit more later about phishing and how that works, but that is what this, I think, is focused on. So Catherine Archuleta, the director of the Office of Personnel Management, former director of the Office of Personnel Management, stated in testimony to Congress just a couple weeks ago that they had been in the process of updating all their systems' security and developing an improved security posture. Fact is, though, it was too little and too late. Their efforts were complicated by years of incremental contracting, political favors, and government shutdowns that caught up with them in the end. They had failed in fixing these systems and protecting the data that is most important to protect the integrity of our own government. You know, as the OPM breach highlights, along with the countless others that we hear about, we don't just need cybersecurity, we need new approaches that involve at least the recognition that there are serious problems with our technology infrastructure. And these problems are being exploited to gain access to our personal data and perhaps even fund attempts to gain control over the commerce that flows through the internet. Our economy today is run off of ideas. New ideas are the fuel for growth in our today's world. And there are generally three ways that you can get this fuel. You can generate ideas. That's one way. You can purchase them from others. That's another way. Or you can, as many people are doing in these hacks, steal these ideas. The internet has enabled all of these approaches, and it has especially enabled the ability to steal and make it easier to do that. You know, stealing ideas, though, is not unique, not even to the internet. And it could be argued that technology has made it easier to do this in many respects. You know, most notable is that an attacker thousands of miles away can gain access to an organization's inner workings and files and then utilize that, have those things sold with by the end of the day, and run off with millions of dollars. You know, our culture supports the protection of intellectual property, while at the same time, though, we have some folks that we do celebrate of liberators of those ideas or that intellectual property. So there is a bit of a duality going on there. An example of this is Apple Computer's Steve Jobs. Everyone, I think, knows who Mr. Jobs was. And he made some famous quotes relating to this. In 1996, you know, regarding a lawsuit between Xerox and Apple, here's what Steve said. Picasso had a saying, good artists copy, great artists steal. and we have always been shameless about stealing great ideas. But this is the same Steve Jobs who also stated he would go nuclear on Google for stealing ideas related to iOS and the iPhone. I don't necessarily see the difference. You can see, though, that this having this at least one individual, as well as many others, present this conflicting interest on the protection of intellectual property sends an inconsistent message to our youth. At the very least, it makes it easier for others in other parts of the world, in other cultures, to justify that same behavior and then try to bring these goods to their citizens for cheaper. You know, being able to steal ideas or goods that are moving between countries has been a deliberate strategy for growth for many cultures throughout history. Those folks that control the ports, the roads, the pathways for commerce have also been able to propel themselves to great wealth and power. In addition, these roads also became the vessels for the propagation of ideas and faiths, and that have shaped our world that we live in today. Certainly, this free flow of goods and ideas has been a driving force behind the world's growth, and a positive one at that. And our successes, despite those who have attempted to control it. And the internet has enabled this now today at light speed. So allow me to just digress a little bit as I talk a little bit about history and relate some history to how our current state in cybersecurity is now. In 1206 AD, a man named Temujin began his ascent to power by leading raids against city-states in the Asian steppes. Temujin's strategy centered on controlling the roads of commerce and trade of that time, which in turn made his empire one of the largest, richest, and most feared of its time. To do this, he organized multiple tribes and cultures in the regions around a common goal: prosperity for all. Well, at least those who did not contest their own control of it, right? He didn't do this by creating new products, though. There weren't new products to sell. There was no farms, no goods coming out of what they were doing. But it was accomplished simply by raiding the prosperous individual city-states and kingdoms. His hordes controlled the roads that commerce flowed through, and as such, they were able to negotiate and extract lots of tribute from these city-states. The influence of this culture ranged from the coast of Korea to eastern Poland. And the rise of these peoples of the Asian steppes lasted for at least two centuries, and the impact was felt well into the 19th. We know this man today as... anybody? Genghis Khan. So his actual real name was Temujin. So he and his ancestors were responsible for the complete domination of the Eurasian continent for two centuries, and from the conquering of the Russians to the establishment of the Yuan dynasty and the founding of what we now call Beijing, China, he and his heirs, including his grandson Kublai Khan, were masters of the world at that time in terms of their influence and control and their complete dominance of the Silk Road. So Khan very much understood the importance of communication for managing his empire. That's why he set up an email system, which he controlled. Excuse me, did I say email? A mail system that he controlled. And that mail system was facilitated by horsemen who would ride 125 miles a day to deliver mail between stopping points. Now he was able to control that, right, because those people that were riding were his people. So he was able to see what that knowledge was, what those ideas were, and what was in the messages that were being sent. Truly, the Mongols understood the control of these pathways of commerce and the relationship to safe and efficient communication throughout the empire. Well, at least the control communication, right? So when your riders provide that mail, though, it means they're able to intercept it and look through it and develop ways in which that they could respond to what was going on. So what is different today, though, than in the past, right? How are we different than what has preceded us? The struggle between the Mongols' strategy for conquering and control and dominance and the city-states that they were conquering is analogous to the battle we're dealing with in cybersecurity today. Multiple tribes or groups use the internet to access and deal in information legally and illegally. And although the internet was created as a free and open society, There is a continual onslaught to extract tribute from all of us as it becomes more ingrained into our daily lives. Let me give you a brief example of that. For example, we see many times computers that are infected with a type of program called malware that locks the data from the users on boot up. We call this ransomware. You can imagine being presented with a screen upon the boot up of your computer that says it will not release your data until you contact a particular organization and pay $500 or $250 or $725, whatever the number is, right? Our data is so valuable that we only briefly consider not paying. The initial reaction would be, gosh, I'm not paying that. But then you realize all that you have within your data and how valuable that is to you personally. This tribute is more than likely funding organized crime and maybe even nation states. In addition, there are other things that are different today as well. The aggregation of the individuals on the internet coalesce along ideological boundaries, not necessarily along location, physical boundaries, or on tribal boundaries. This has allowed for small and even fringe groups to become global players in the terror network, and internet access allows for easier recruiting of these people. I think the examples when we see people being recruited into ISIS shows that they're being recruited through the internet. Second, the deep interconnectedness is also providing a pathway into some of the most individualized attacks and targeting known to date. For example, if someone were to have access to your Facebook account, they might be able to extract what you like, what you don't like, what you believed in the past, what you look forward to in the future. All that from mining the data within social media. Oh, wait, they don't have to hack your account. All they have to do is pay Facebook for that. Something to keep in mind, right? So to understand these reasons for our current dilemma in cybersecurity, it's important to understand its origins. Like many of the disruptive technologies like the railroad and telegraph, its origins are rooted in understanding the individuals who push the limits of this technology and commit these breaches. These people, again, you know, we're using this in vernacular now, but they're hackers, right? They commit these breaches. They hack for monetary, ideological, and political motives, and they have a natural tendency for checking, verifying, and digging into systems to find where their weaknesses are. Oh, wait a minute. We're in the press club. That's what a journalist does, right? No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, Bob. Seriously, though, hacking and the unauthorized use of data or systems has a long history. Intercepting messages, encrypting communications dates to the time of Caesar and early Rome. Specifically, though, related to electronic communications, you should put yourself in a nice spot where you think about a sunny day in 1903. Arrival of Marconi, Neville Maskelyne, interrupted the first public demonstration of Marconi's wireless Morse code transmitter by sending an unauthorized transmission to it in the demonstration. Needless to say, Marconi was not amused to find that his secure method of transmission was vulnerable. 1903. Many other incidents in the history go on and on, all the way through World War II, and even some in World War II turned the tide of that war, as some of the latest movies have shown in the history that we've looked at. Modern-day hacking, though, finds its roots in the early 1960s. There was a countercultural shift in America where the Youth International Party began publishing ways in which that you could freak, is the word, and that's with a P-H-R-E-A-K, or hack the phone system to get free long distance to do other things. Now, the interesting thing is that this was an amazing discovery that was discovered by a 7-year-old blind child in Virginia named Joe Ingresia. Now, Joe had learned, since he had perfect pitch, that he could whistle into the phone and make the switch back in the back end at the PBX change what it needed to do. In other words, he could get free long distance by doing that. It should be noted, too, that, again, and I don't have it in for Mr. Jobs, but he's a great example because he's been a wonderful example of success. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started Apple Computer by funding it through the sale of those boxes that would get that kind of phone service to be able to get free long distance. So it is ingrained in our culture. This hacking mentality is not just something that is foreign. It's something that we all have within us. So the Yippies matured. That's what they're called, Youth International Party. They went through, continued to progress through the 70s and the 80s. And in the 90s, they were given a platform. This platform was there to help them propagate what they were going to do in terms of their hacker culture. However, I don't think that when they invented the platform, they were intending that. This platform, though, arose out of the fears and the concerns of World War II from the rise of communism, real or perceived. And it's defined many of us that were born before the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. So briefly, this is how this platform came to be. On a fall evening in October 29th, 1969, a technician in a lab in UCLA sent a message through a computer to another computer at Stanford Research Labs. Now, this was not necessarily unique, except that this was a part of an experiment, and the experiment was a success. And the success was for developing what was known as the ARPANET, or as we know it today, the Internet. So that is the birth of that particular aspect, 1969. So in the 90s, the convergence, though, of this hacker culture, along with the liberation of the Internet, that's sponsored by Al Gore, though, not invented, okay, has changed the way we live, love, and work on this planet, and is still disrupting and changing our lives today. Many of us find ourselves spending lots of time in virtual worlds, ignoring the physical realm almost as we prefer these deeply rich gaming environments. I know my kids would love to do that incessantly, but we do limit that. Many of these items have no physical presence. Software, ebooks, game tokens, and now more recently, money in the form of Bitcoin. So this deep linkage, at least this digital linkage that we have to each other, whether we like it or not, it's gotten deeper. We coalesce in these online tribal groups based upon interest rather than location like never before. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and probably about six others that my teenager knows and I don't, are a few of the congregation points that people find themselves on the Internet. This information flows like a river through these services, and as a result, so do these ideas and concepts, much like the proliferation of ideas and faiths did on the Silk Road. It's an understatement to say that the Internet has been a boon to our economy, but a bane to our privacy. One cannot help but notice that every day there's a new data breach being reported, and each one is progressively worse. How do we continue to grow and leverage the benefits of technology to both improve our lives and economy while still protecting our privacy? This is the question that keeps me up at night. Having been in the generation that saw this transition firsthand unfold in front of us, I'm personally invested in making sure that my children have a world where they reap the benefits of the freedom of information without the negatives that this freedom brings sometimes. It is important to outline a little bit the current state. So we talked a little bit, Marcia talked a little bit about some of the most recent breaches. I'm going to dive into that a little bit. I'm not a Debbie Downer, so to speak, necessarily, so please understand this is to help us understand a little bit more about really the breadth of the problem. We're going to talk a little bit about the identified perpetrators and what we know about them at this time. And I promise I'll stop before we feel the need to just unplug our computers, throw them in the trash, and go outside. So who are the raiders, the hordes on the Internet today, and what is their purpose? What are they attempting to control? In 2010, and this is dated information, right, Mandiant, a security company, published a first report that actually identified who was behind most of the attacks up to that time. They even went so far as to point at the Chinese government, although not directly, as being behind a large amount of these, upwards of maybe 60 to 80% of these attacks on U.S. infrastructure and organization. In addition, they even identified the location in the building which these people resided in. Ironically, this group is located in Western China. in the Yinyang province in an area populated by people that the Mongols had trouble conquering, the Uyghurs. In addition, it should be noted that upwards of 60 to 80% of the attacks also come, along with China, come from the Russia and Ukraine as well. Now, this group was not the sole group of responsible. There's lots and lots of different groups. They were upwards in number of at least 30,000 or more, which makes them one of the largest hacking groups out there, at least that is state-sponsored that we know about. I should always preface that. Specifically, the report identifies, though, that they systematically stole hundreds of terabytes, that's terabytes, of data from at least 141 organizations. And remember, the report was from 2010. 5 years have since happened since then, right? They demonstrated the capability and intent to steal from dozens of organizations simultaneously, and they noted that the building that houses the People's Liberation Army is the exact building in which the group, APT-1, resides. Probably not a coincidence. The recent breaches against the Blues, meaning Anthem and Primera and Care First now, three of the 37 Blue Cross Blue Shield organizations, and the Office of Management Personnel are examples of the attempt to obtain personal information for later exploitation and targeted attacks and potentially blackmail. For example, we were just talking about this. If you knew, for example, if they knew your health history and you had a particular, say, diabetes or something else that was concerning you, and then you received an email from someone, maybe even posing as your doctor or posing as your insurance company or posing as your health clinic, you might react to that and click on a link in there quicker than you would if it just came from, you know, so-and-so with a random email address and a random URL to click. This is the intent of this data, in my opinion, is to do more targeted attacks. Later, I'll provide an example of a company here in town that was actually a victim of that kind of attack. You know, besides making it easier for outside groups to steal our data, hacking has made it also easier for our own government to spy directly on its citizens in order to prevent the physical attacks like of 9/11 or other countless terrorist attacks. We wouldn't have known this without the efforts of people like Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden. Chelsea Manning, if you recall, released multiple classified documents related to the Iraq War to WikiLeaks. Edward Snowden, a former CIA employee and NSA contractor, released the bulk of the documents that revealed a more invasive approach to democracy than what we like to think we have. Revelations from this documentation continue to astound in their depth and quantity, the most damaging being, of course, the revelation of the domestic spying program and spying on foreign heads of state that has damaged our trust of the U.S. government, both internally and externally. Now, I'm not saying that Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden were justified in their actions. They certainly performed criminal activity in order to release the information they did. But truly, the government has also not done their job when it comes to protecting our data. However, they're in the same boat that the rest of us are. No one is immune. You know, it could be argued that many attacks were prevented as a result of that domestic spying program, but you can't help but wonder what damage this has done to our credibility internationally as a country. And now recently, with the attacks on the Office of Personnel Management, and of course we didn't mention healthcare.gov, the IRS, that further eroded our faith in whether or not our government can actually build its infrastructure to the point that it can protect the data that it's entrusted with. You know, secrecy is the currency of the dictator. The openness with which we live in our society, though, is being used against us to exploit our systems and our economy. To further put an exclamation on some of these points, let me go through just some of the facts that might help us understand a little bit. Verizon publishes these statistics. They have a cybersecurity practice, and they're quite interesting. In 2014, there were 312 breaches, up from 253 in 2013. There were 348 million identities exposed in 2014. The average breach exposed 1.1 million identities in 2014. And the top three industry sectors that were breached were healthcare, retail, and yes, higher education. The Ponemon Institute is another research think tank started by Larry Ponemon. Now, Larry focuses his research on breaches, the cost of breaches, and how that relates to the governance activities that go on in cybersecurity. Some of these facts are even more sobering. The average cost of a data breach for higher education is now $300 per lost record. The average cost of a data breach for the United States across all sectors is $217 per record. This means that if you had a breach of 150,000 records, an institution, for example, in higher education could expect to spend $45 million in direct and indirect expenses. That's money I know we don't have. On the other hand, that number is probably a little bit hyperbolic in the fact that it's not taken into account some of the other aspects. Even if it's half, even if it's a quarter, it's still too much. You know, an example of this can be found recently. Since some of you may not be in the higher education space, you may not be tracking a particular issue that's going on in Arizona. Maricopa Community College is the largest community college system in Arizona, and one of the largest in the country. They've had multiple breaches since 2013. They've refused to fix the problems because they've had squabbling in their board of regents over how to do it and who should do it. Now they're dealing with two class action lawsuits where the request for compensatory damages is averaging out at $2,500 per identity. They lost 2.5 million records. That's a sobering number. That's $6 billion per class action lawsuit. $6 billion. I'm pretty sure the people of the state of Arizona do not want to pay $12 billion, or even if it's just a fourth of that, $3 billion, to bail that out. They're in a bit of a pickle. Pay attention to this one. This is still in its infancy. And over the next couple of years, we'll see exactly how this comes out, because this will be a bellwether for how we handle cybersecurity in higher education over the next 15 years. These numbers are staggering, though. But how does this affect us directly? You know, some further information from Ponemon says that over 76% of people who have been notified that they've experienced a breach experience stress, enough stress that they can remember it. Of course, I can say that that's probably not as much stress as the people experiencing the breach that are actually recovering from it. But 56% of people, though, responded and said that they would most likely not want to do business with that organization again after that breach. I don't know about you, but I don't know too many organizations that could lose half their customers and still survive. To me, cybersecurity is no longer an IT issue. It really never was. It's a business sustainability issue. You know, we've got lots of data breaches we could talk about. We could go on forever, but we don't want to do that, right? I do want to talk about two in particular, besides Maricopa. So Maricopa is interesting from a legal perspective because of the class action lawsuit. The most recent one, where it did not really involve any data that could be sold, such as Social Security numbers or credit card numbers, was the Sony Pictures hack that took place in the last part of December in 2014. This is where their company's inner workings were completely exposed. It was perpetrated by Lizard Squad, may have been hired by North Korea. I don't know that that's truly been confirmed. Could have caused an international incident if people would have reacted and not had cooler heads. The Lizard Squad group actually paid systems administrators from Sony who had been fired 2 to 3 weeks prior to the breach for the inside information to get in. This is going to cost Sony $35 million to repair their systems. Now, they say there's no bottom line impact, so that could be very well. The CEO is gone, and also all the top-level cabinet of that corporation is gone. And it's yet to be seen whether or not any talent will continue working with Sony Pictures in the future. Maybe they will. I mean, people usually have short memories. I know I do. And it's interesting to note it began with a phishing attack to their iPhones. So let's talk a little bit about Target. Target was mentioned earlier. I think it's all got at least the most press of most of the breaches. That was begun from someone working on their heating, ventilating, and air conditioning system. the malware was, excuse me, the hackers were able to get onto their network that way, insert malware into their point of sale systems, and then extract over 110 million credit card and debit card numbers. Now, after that, their systems did detect the intrusion within hours. The team in India notified the team in Minneapolis, and the team in Minneapolis didn't respond for over 2 weeks. So by then, it was too late. The data had already been exfiltrated or stolen. Okay. So since then, right, what do we know since then? Well, Target stock price is back to where it was, although it experienced a 46% drop in profit in the fourth quarter of 2013. The cost of to the banks and credit unions to reissue cards, and I imagine there was some that got reissued with First National as well, $200 million. $100 million to upgrade all the terminals. Class action lawsuit just settled here recently for $10 million. With a total estimated loss and upwards of over $1 billion. Now Target has recently, in the first quarter of this year, laid off 13% of its workforce. What does this mean? You know, they're just one of the many companies whose primary focus, right, is on keeping the business going, focusing on shareholder value, keeping things like support services like IT, security, compliance, support, keeping those down, so they can stay focused on bringing that shareholder value. Wait a minute. 46% drop in profit. Stock price drops to half, although it has recovered. CEO gone. CIO gone, as well as the top layer of management. And now 13% of their workforce? I'd say they've failed to meet their corporate growth objectives. Incidentally, it should be noted that they did not have a chief information security officer. I'm not saying that that's a great thing necessarily, but you can see that they didn't have one person who was responsible for security to ensure that they were doing what they should have been doing. They do now, though. So what should we demand as citizens, right, of the people that we're sharing our information with? Should we expect them to take care of it? And so why aren't they doing that? Why aren't companies and organizations doing that? I think it depends how you define value, right? Our value that we get, I think, is derived from a balance of governance and growth. It's not growth only. However, many corporations have lost sight of that, and nonprofits as well. And they're focusing strictly on growing whatever it is they're growing. In the nonprofit sector, many times it's not on growth as much as it's on cost reduction and making sure that you do as much as possible with as little as possible. And those are great goals. But there has to be balance in that mindset. You know, the OPM breach highlights this perfectly, right? They've had to endure multiple government shutdowns and political appointments while still trying to secure their systems. I imagine the data taken in this case was not necessarily data that seems to have value in the short term, but in the long term, it will find a use with the hackers for a deeper level of manipulation. You know, all these facts, like I said, can be a downer. There is a lot of good news, though. Most of these organizations were quite resilient in their responses. And we are certainly focused on this issue now as a country. And I have great faith that we're going to continue to make headway in preventing these attacks. And there is more information sharing going on now between government agencies and the private sector and the nonprofit sector than there ever has been. There are multiple organizations being developed and multiple that are in the process of being developed by Homeland Security and the FBI to help us all work together to defend against these attacks. At UNO, for example, we use this shared data from the Homeland Security and from the FBI to block 2.5 million attacks on our network. Not a week. That's a day, 2.5 million a day. And I imagine many other organizations experience 2 to 3 times more of those kinds of attacks on their networks. In addition, we have to be careful not to focus solely on the negative. It can be real easy to be caught up in all, what are we going to do here? For fear of losing track of the fact that we are getting better as a whole in protecting our data.
I think the latest set of executive memoranda from the White House shows that there's a deep recognition that cybersecurity is a national issue and needs to have something done. Individuals who want to know how to protect themselves and are hungry for the information on how to do it. We're all wanting to know, what can we do? How can we help? So what can you do personally? Don't use personal information if you can avoid it. Keep a list of who has your data, right? Make sure that the folks that ask you for the data that you're giving them, that they have a right to know that data, and ask them what they're wanting to use that data for. Use secure passwords. That's always a tough one, right? 123456 is not secure. You know, but you can put a couple of periods in there. Put some punctuation marks. Make it a little more complicated. Come up with a phrase that'll help you remember that password while at the same time making it difficult for crackers to get it. Encrypt your data. Make sure and lock down your Wi-Fi. When in doubt, throw it out. Too often, you know, I think we all heard stories back in the 80s and 90s of people that would piece together shredded statements, et cetera, to get account numbers and social numbers from it. They can still do that today, right? So throw that stuff out. Now, Data Privacy Day is January 28th. So that's a day I would recommend, because you can use that day to remind yourself to take all that electronic data, all that physical data that you don't really need, and take it to Data Shield. Take it to a company here in town that'll provide free removal of that data. If you're a victim, report it to the IC3. That's the Internet Complaint Crime Unit, and that's www.ic3.gov. But without those reports, they have no idea necessarily what's going on. You may be just one of a larger group of victims. And don't use public hotspots. Oh, no, wait, I didn't say that. Be careful when you use public hotspots. I'm sure there's one here, and it's perfectly secure, so you may use that one, absolutely. But an example of this would be Starbucks here recently. So Starbucks provides Wi-Fi for the people, their folks that are in their coffee shops. And at the same time, there were hackers who were hanging out in their coffee shops using that Wi-Fi to get access to their Starbucks gift cards that they were using, and then reloading those. I know that because an individual that had reported it first noticed their email went off about 10 times in 7 minutes, where there was a $50 reload on their Starbucks card each time. So $500 in 7 minutes, gone. So not something we want to have happen. You know, there's a great governmental resource to use. There's staysafeonline.org and there's stopthinkconnect.org. And, you know, nothing is perfect, but I would say these have certainly provide exemplary leadership in security awareness and making sure that we understand what we can do personally. But what can we all do? If we act as individuals, we won't be able to actually do a whole lot other than against these groups and these hordes that are trying to take our data. You know, we aren't bringing our own security into the IRS or into the Office of Personnel Management. We have four things, though, that I think that we should do to win this war on our digital lives. The first is education. Cybersecurity literacy needs to begin in elementary school and continue to through college as a requirement. Imagine if we could marshal an army of the 4 billion or so users of the Internet to better defend themselves personally. That could do wonders. Board visibility. Boards need to start taking the cyber threats seriously. And some have. But all boards do. Corporate boards, nonprofit boards, and yes, even educational boards. Recognizing that this is an expense for the digital economy is a key piece of defending these attacks, and then making sure that people are assigned and funded to do that. So this next one is an interesting one. We need to support law enforcement. Law enforcement needs the tools and the expertise to defend us in battle. That's what they're charged with. They do not need, however, shortcuts that sacrifice the very ideals that make America what it is and what it has been for 239 years. And finally, in my opinion, the most important thing that we can do, from my perspective, is collaboration. Threat information sharing and collaboration on the cost of defense are a key to defending against these overwhelming odds. Those that seek to obtain our data will exploit our own selfish interests, our own silos, and our own bureaucracy, and as such, we become our own worst enemies. One of the key reasons Genghis Khan was able to be so successful is that the city-states that he attacked were not in direct contact or collaboration with the other surrounding states. Thus, they had fewer numbers, less resources, and finally, no one to help when the Mongols were at the gates of the city. Now, certainly, military strategy and complete ruthlessness also played a role in their dominance. However, it didn't help to be facing an enemy of this strength without assistance. On a cool April morning in 1241 AD, Duke Henry II was faced with the Mongols, led by Subutai, Genghis Khan's greatest general, on the field in Legnica, Poland. I like to imagine, because I'm just odd, what it would be like to be one of his commanders. What would I say? I would probably ask, how are we going to face such an army? I imagine the Duke responding, knowing what probable fate lay ahead of all of us, look back and respond calmly, together. Now, the Polish, the Czechs, and the Germans were soundly defeated that day, but my daydream still provides an insight of how we win against what seemed like overwhelming odds and a very difficult situation. Because the fact is, the Mongols were actually more together that day than the Duke and his forces. And the key to winning a battle, violent or not, as Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. have shown us, is by standing together. Collaboration is the key to defeat those who will take our privacy and ultimately our resources. Transparent discussion and threat sharing, along with the sharing of our skills, can become an amplifying force. The same is true for cybersecurity in our time. We must begin to develop methods and systems of sharing information about threats in a transparent, fair manner, and collaborating on the costs to help provide this magnifying force. We must reach across all sectors, public, private, law enforcement, and begin to find ways to trust each other with this information so we can respond to this threat together. Thank you. Are there any questions? How much should institutions invest in information assurance? I think that depends mostly upon the risk that you're dealing with. So the amount that you would invest in an organization or a corporation is related to the value that you're providing. So if you are providing a particular value to your customers, what would it take to make sure that that's protected if you lost all of them, right? We call that return on security investment. It's complicated. It's related to how insurance is calculated, and insurance is part of that equation. Hopefully that answers that. Or I could just say $10 million. Would that work too? Okay. Why do you think higher education is a target at the level of healthcare and retail? I would say that the reason higher ed is up in the same sector as healthcare and retail is that we have a confluence of forces on us that allows, we have open borders, so to speak. We have a lot of open sharing. I mean, that's what higher education is about, right? Is sharing information and teaching. And at the same time, that openness provides an ingress point into our systems and our networks that put us at risk. And so that they're able to harvest lots of IDs in those environments, as opposed to like in the healthcare agent areas and retail. Retail is probably more about money, and healthcare is more about selling health records. So, this isn't from my wife, is it? It says, how are hackers able to file tax returns on someone else's accounts? This happened this year. So, isn't there a check and balance with the W-2 forms? I don't know. We'd have to ask the IRS, but that's a very good question. When we find out that, I'd like to know that myself as well. Briefly, though, what's happened is your SOCH number has been acquired through some other means. So there's been a breach somewhere else. with your Social Security number, and as a result, they were able to file that before you filed. So, and it's a lengthy process to get it taken care of. I've heard this is becoming more common. How is data stolen through outdoor purchase of gasoline via the credit card? Well, the gasoline pumps have a similar setup, just like a point-of-sale system does with the swiper. There's a couple of different ways that that can happen. They can put a device on the swiper that will actually extract the card data information. They could also be intercepting it at the gas station's centralized system. In other words, the gas station has to aggregate that data and then send it on. There are other ways of dealing with that, though, that people are getting smarter about. So they're pushing that data in an encrypted fashion before it even gets to the gas station. Who is liable for a data breach? The owner of the data or the service provider? Well, that depends on the legal contract that's been put in place, right? Generally, it's been identified in most legislation as the service provider. But it could be if you had two organizations that were sharing data, and it wasn't in the contract who was responsible for the breach, it'll end up being the owner. At what point of data transfer from owner to service provider? A breach occurred on whose watch? Yeah, there's many non-public legal proceedings on this right now as to determining who is going to be responsible for those things. But again, it comes down to the writing of the contract and what was in that contract agreement. If there was nothing in that agreement, then they have to defer to the local law and probably look to see if there was negligence involved. What is one thing everyone can do? Well, one thing I think would be great is just to highlight this to your representative, to your congressman, to your senators. Make sure they understand that even though we're supportive of the culture that we have and the corporation's growth, because we all benefit from our free society here in the U.S., we do need a stronger focus on making sure that there is proper balance and governance in that. Who or what do you think is behind most threats? I think primarily you've got some nation-state / organized crime elements that are mostly utilizing this to fund other items. Perhaps in North Korea you could fund your military program. China, I don't know what theirs has been, mostly focused on intellectual property. And you might find it interesting, you know, that the issue going on in eastern Ukraine right now is also one of the havens for the most hackers in the world, too, besides Western China. So it's something to think about. How effective are companies like LifeLock or MyLife.com? You know, the value that that service adds is just on top of what you can do yourself through another credit monitoring firm and so forth. I haven't actually used LifeLock or MyLife. What they're talking about there is, I believe LifeLock claims that they will lock down and clean out your social number or any other personal data that you have across the internet. You know, Google has some great tools, too, to help scrub across the internet and make sure that your public details or private details are private. Recently, I saw a headline somewhere that World War III will not start in the usual way, but that it'll is it possible it's a dramatic catch. I think the gist of the question here is that World War III will not start like it would have, like in the previous wars where there was like actual shooting and things like that, but that'll actually start with cyber war. That is possible. Let's just hope we don't get to that point. But I think that is probably a little bit of hyperbole on some headlines choice, too, to kind of get some attention.
We have a round of applause for Mr. Morton.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker has been Matt Morton, Chief Information Security Officer and Assistant Chief Information Officer for the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He spoke on the topic, Cybersecurity in a Global Economy, How Do We Assure Growth While Protecting Our Digital Lives? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, July 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be this Thursday, September 17th at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Thomas Gutierrez, the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies and Dean of International Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. As he prepares to retire after a 41-year career at UNO, he will talk about his career and his role in two wars, the Cold War and the War on Terror. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.